Hey, how are you?
Yeah, I'm all good. Thanks, Hayley.
Are you excited for our topic on bone density and bone health today?
Always. I'm always up for learning.
Well, I thought it'd be interesting to talk about what differences there are in men and females as with bone density, because we often see in clinic postmenopausal ladies coming to see us in clinic, and it is a condition that particularly affects or changes more significantly for women as opposed to men. So about 200 million postmenopausal women will suffer with a condition called osteoporosis. And osteoporosis is where the change in the bone occurs. So due to estrogen effects in the body, as that declines as we get older through the menopausal years, it has an impact on our bone. And that leaves us quite vulnerable to suffering a fracture, especially as we grow older, if we don't try to maintain good bone density. And we don't often think about what we've done in our younger years. So when we're sort of up to the age of 20, little do we know sometimes that we're forming the bone density at the time. And when you are young, you need to be doing lots of weight bearing and high impact exercise to kind of help that bone matrix. But sadly, after the age of 20, especially in women, the hip and the spine bone cells have actually sort of fully formed and all the bone density has occurred at that stage. And then as we get older, some of the other bones, like the peripheral bones, like the radius, which is the bone in the forearm, starts to go down from the age of about 30 to 40, and it declines thereafter. So we want to try and maximize the bone density when we're younger, and because it kind of stores it up ready for when we're older. And good news for guys, because you guys are a little bit luckier than us ladies, because it tends to drop off your bone density, Henry, from the age of about 53, 54. It starts to gradually decline. So again, it's something that men need to think about too, but it's even more essential for ladies. Did you know about your bone density dropping off at that age, Henry?
Well, I've heard of osteoporosis, and I have heard that it's more in that kind of postmenopausal women. I have heard that, but I haven't particularly thought about it a lot. But I guess what you hear about is, you know, whether it's a grandparent or someone you know, and then they fall over and they fracture their hip, or, you know, they break a bone. And that's normally a kind of worrying sign that, like, well, maybe they'll start to decline in other ways because now they're not so mobile, they can't get out. So maybe where they used to, you know, go hang out with their friends, now they can't get around so much. And then they're stuck at home and now they're watching daytime TV. And now suddenly, you know, they're not, you know, doing as much. And that, you know, you always hear when like an older person breaks a hip, it's like, oh, you know, well, that's not great. Like, hopefully they can bounce back. And I guess, you know, I try not to fall over, but I have fallen over, and I don't tend to break hips. So I kind of assume my bones are probably fairly strong. But that was interesting you were saying about that up until you're 20 is a kind of the time to, you know, kind of build that density. And so does that mean that, you know, if you've got kids and they're kind of, you know, those teenage years doing lots of impacts, or is that like kind of sport and making sure they're not just sitting around and playing computer games, they're actually getting out and, I don't know, is it like falling out of trees? I don't know, what kind of impact is good, is it?
Yeah, so absolutely. So the up to age 20 is for the hip and the spine predominantly, and then sort of after the age of 40, it's the radius and other bones. So it starts to go down. But in terms of spine and hips bones, then yeah, in your younger years and for all our bones, we need to try and kind of build that good high density bone strength. And that's achieved mainly through resistance, so body resistance exercise or high impact training. So that would be things like jumping, skipping, playing sport. Like you said, you might get involved in doing sort of kiddie type exercises. So something that we sometimes see even in our younger population, sometimes children are quite weak because of the effects of having sort of sat and done gaming or other computer game type things. And they lose a lot of strength and stability around their shoulders and their scapula, which is their shoulder blades. And they're so sort of weak that they can't even do things like, you remember when you're a kid, you do like those wheelbarrow walking and you hold them by the legs and you kind of walk along. You know, they can't do that for very long because we've just got a little bit weaker because of everything that we tend to do, you know, kids as they go through teenage years and things as well, they might be on mobile phones more, you know, iPads, that sort of thing, computers, laptops. So we don't necessarily, you know, jump around, climb trees, go and play more sports. I mean, there'll be some teenagers that do more kind of physical activity, But we tend to find you're either in group one, which is the high impact, do sport regularly, or you're in the other group, which is never really think about exercise, hardly doing anything at all. So that's the group that we're particularly concerned about, because it's what you do in your younger years that's setting you up for that older years. And especially if you know, like, a grandparent that might have osteoporosis, you know, sometimes these things can run in families. So if you know that you've got a little bit of a risk factor from any genetics, or just generally that it might need to be really important for you to actually strengthen up and really think about that. And the more we can do, the better, because obviously it does set you up for when you're older. Like you said, you don't want to be falling, because if you fall over,
it's quite a hard, that's quite a hard sell though, isn't it, to tell someone who's 18, oh, by the way, when you're 70, they'll be like, what? Like, they're not even thinking about tomorrow. Yeah, totally. But actually, that kind of, I guess if you're a parent, you can kind of encourage your kids to, you know, at least do something. And is there like an optimal amount, or is it just make sure you're doing something over nothing? Or is it because I guess the kind of, you would think that doing stuff like, it's like rugby or netball or football or something that's kind of physical and you'll run around, that you'll be more prone to getting injured. But actually what you're kind of saying is that actually by doing something with a bit of impact and moving around, that you're going to be better off later on in life. It's kind of, it's a bit kind of reverse.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you, so with things like rugby, if you're quite into sport and things like that, yes, you'll be running around, loading, that kind of foot striking to the ground is going to be sort of shocking the body, and that's what helps the bone form. And if you're doing that sort of thing and you're naturally building strength, anything, even if you do other forms of exercise, then you're going to bounce back from whatever injury or any condition faster. And that's why it's so important. Like you say, it's a hard sell, because often children won't be thinking about that. And we're seeing the impact nowadays, because obviously these chronic conditions, osteoporosis is also considered a little bit of a metabolic disorder, and about absorptions and vitamins and what we need to do for our body to help keep the bone nice and strong. And that again is a hard sell, and it's something that I always think should be taught in schools. Some schools might be teaching that, and I'd be very impressed if they were, because that's exactly what we need to be teaching our children. And it's really like, it's that if osteoporosis or a break or a fracture when you're older is really debilitating, and it's like the fourth biggest cause of death from a break. So it's not like this is like low priority. It's hugely impacts on your life, because, you know, you're, like you said, you're not going to be as mobile, you're not going to be able to move around as much for a long period of time, and it's extremely painful. So any patients who have ever had a fracture, either in their spine or in the hip, it's a long process through recovery, and it's very frightening as well. And you can have, with these kind of conditions, you can have multiple fractures as well, so they can appear. There are medications that people can take when they're older to try and stop the breakdown of our bone. That's how they work. So there's something called bisphosphonates that you can take. So if you're at risk of osteoporosis, or if you've been told that you're osteopenic, which is like the precursor to osteoporosis, then some patients will be given a bisphosphonate medication to stop any further breakdown. But it's not just with natural deterioration of our bone density because of declining estrogen or hormonal levels in a female. It could be something like cancer treatments. So we see a lot of people who've gone through cancer treatments, and with that effect, that can leave the bone quite sort of vulnerable too. So they're often quite osteopenic. So it's important for that patient group to also consider what exercise they're doing. And with all kind of guidelines, aerobic exercise is often said that you should be doing 150 minutes a week, which is approximately 30 minutes, five times a week. But in terms of resistance and strength training, 3 to 5 times a week is a good amount to do. And that should be sort of doing multiple sets of resistance. But you have to be a bit careful, because if you're a patient who might have had a fracture, you can't just go to necessarily a regular gym and go and start squatting with a load of weights, because there's things that you should and shouldn't do. Things that people can't actually do because they have sort of actually degenerated in terms of fitness level already. And that's a precursor that's built up over time. So, you know, you can have somebody who's quite slender, and usually it's the people who are a little bit more underweight. So if their body mass index is lower can be more susceptible to these kind of conditions. So if you're a little bit thinner, but you know you haven't really got much muscle mass, that's going to be hard to build up. So there's quite specific things that you need to work on. But again, like you say, it's not something you think about when you're younger. But if you have anyone in your family sort of growing up, seeing grandparents, it should make you stop and think about it. But it's a very difficult thing to try to get people to do.
So you said at the beginning that it affects women more than men. So say my wife, as an example, she's approaching menopause. She's not, but like, let's assume, you know, fast forward a decade or so, and she knows in her childhood she did no sport. She basically sat in the library and read books, and you know, so she wasn't doing impact exercise. And now she's suddenly worrying of like, oh, actually, you know, I know that something happened with my grandparents, and I've got, you know, I can see a future that's happening because she's now listened to this podcast. What kind of things could she do that, because obviously she can't go back to her 20s and be like, right, now let's do some resistance. Is there things that she can do right now that could, like, you know, help? Or is there really kind of like, if you've had a, you know, 50 years of doing nothing or not enough, you're kind of at the mercy? Or is there things that can move the dial, if that makes sense?
Yeah. So with females, they say, people in their 50s, it's like half of women in their 50s will have a break due to like a fracture due to osteoporosis. And one in five men would have a similar fracture due to an osteoporotic condition. So it's much less common in men. And a bit like your wife, you know, I studied all through my younger years and obviously tried to do a bit of exercise, but I wasn't a physio when I was 17. You know, I don't think I even probably thought about it at that point. But it's never too late to improve your physical health in multiple areas. And one of the reasons I ever got into bone density and as a specialist interest area clinically was because my own mother was diagnosed with osteoporosis and she fell through COVID, I think it was, and she kind of blacked out because of the virus, I think, and then she fell and broke her back, and that was picked up just from scans, and then it all escalated from there because it's a silent condition. You don't know it's happening. And the best thing you can do if you're interested is to do what we call a DEXA scan, so it will measure your bone density. And if somebody has like a parent who has got severe osteoporosis, then it's quite useful to know in your sort of 40s and 50s whether you do have a low bone density as well. However, is it going to change management? You might not go on to medications unless you have broken something as well. So you've been playing tennis, you fall over, classic injury, fall out onto a stretched out hand, you fracture your wrist. And then sometimes people will go for scans for some other body part, and it might also be a coincidental finding. They might say, by the way, it looks like your bone density is not great. I think you should have a DEXA scan. So it sometimes gets picked up that way. But in terms of what your wife can do now, it's never too late to build bone strength. So we need our muscles. Obviously, they support our joints. So the stronger our muscles can be, the more kind of resistance and impact that's going to give for the bone. And that's obviously going to try and maintain bone density as best we can, because although we might not form so much as we obviously as we get older, because it is on that decline, we can kind of preserve it better and also think about nutrition and things like that. We know with bone density that we should be thinking about our vitamin D levels. We should be thinking about things like our calcium levels and making sure we get good calcium into our diet. And we know as well from sort of more recent research that vitamin K is also important, because vitamin K works very nicely with vitamin D. So I don't know if your wife takes any of these vitamins, but out of all of them, these are essential ones with regards to bone, because the vitamin K can help push your vitamin D into your bone to kind of preserve it. It's like a I sort of see it as like a signal. It's like the vitamin K is, oh, hold on a minute, vitamin D, it's over there. You need to go into that bone, please. Because otherwise the vitamin D it needs to be sort of absorbed and taken up into the bone. So that's how that works. You know, minimally what people can do if they do nothing else at all, they should be thinking about their vitamin D levels. They should be thinking about the vitamin K. And vitamin K can be found naturally if you've got a good, healthy diet. You might not even need to supplement. You should be thinking about trying to get it from your food sources. So a lot of the K vitamins are from green leafy vegetables, so your broccoli and your spinach and your kale and that sort of thing. Then some of your other K vitamins are found in things like your animal-based products. So I know not everybody can eat those, but things like butter, eggs, even lard sometimes can also help. And that nice. just Yeah, it can really help. So obviously in moderation, because obviously the effects on your cardiac system, but that's where you can find it. So in moderation, and you don't actually need that much. So if you're using, say, butter instead of margarine, just very minimally, you only need, I think it's a microgram per your kilogram of body weight. So if somebody's 65 kilograms, you would only need about 65 micrograms of vitamin K. So it's not a huge amount. So you should, if people are sort of eating good vegetables and a balanced diet, they should be getting what they need.
So you mentioned vitamin D. So obviously, whenever I think about vitamin D is sunshine. And and obviously we've been having a glorious summer and plenty of opportunity to get some good vitamin D, or if you've been on holiday, you know, sitting out in the sun. But obviously, like, I kind of think about my own life, and that, you know, the winter and the autumn can be quite gray, and then, you know, if you spend most of your day indoors in an office, you're kind of, and you're not necessarily getting your vitamin D. So things that I try and do is, you know, when I wake up in the morning, I let the dog out. And then I try and just like stand outside, just even just like 5 minutes, like whether, you know, waiting for the kettle to boil or something, just to try, you know, if there is a bit of sunshine. I don't know if it does anything, but I'm like, well, I'm going to be indoors all day, so this is going to be better than nothing. But I know that a lot of like doctors recommend that you should, particularly over the winter, take like vitamin D supplements, because we're just not getting enough. But like you said, you can get it in food sources. So I guess, you know, get it from the sunshine, but also if you can get it from food, then, you know, that's also going to be good as well, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And you do need both sources. Obviously, in the UK, we're a bit unfortunate that we don't normally have high levels of vitamin D. So it is important that we do get out and about in the daylight. And there's good research to show that if you get out in the early morning sunshine as well, it's particularly good for like your retinas and your eyes. But you you have to balance this out, because you have to watch the, you know, I think it was a clinical nurse specialist that I once had a conversation with, and they said, you know, you only really need about 15 minutes through your forearm. That's as much as you need, the amount of vitamin D through your body. And you have to weigh that up with, you know, not burning yourself and not causing any kind of skin cancers and things. So it's a really hard medium to, like, middle ground to find, because you want that vitamin D from natural sunlight, but you need to watch that you're not getting too much and you're not leaving yourself a bit vulnerable, because like skin cancers are shockingly prevalent. Yeah. And if you burn yourself, it significantly increases your chance of melanoma by 75%. So it's really not good. It's a really tricky one. But we do know that vitamin D is needed for our body, and it's really important for, I think, over 700 different functions in the body. It's incredible. It's an incredible vitamin. And you said, like you said, you can get it in your food as well. So things like egg yolks are high in vitamin D, and we need that from the food sources as well. But we know the highest percentage of vitamin D does come from daylight or sunlight. So we just need to find a nice, happy medium, so that we're just doing the best we can for our body. And I think I take vitamin D supplements. I take them all year round. I found I was a little bit borderline at one point, probably because I'm always in clinic. Always in clinic, and so, you know, don't always manage to get out and all through the day. But sometimes if you take your vitamin D supplements, it is worth thinking about, you know, especially if you are at risk of osteoporosis or you are osteoporotic, making sure you have those other supplements as well, possibly. But you should always check with your GP first, because obviously interactions with other medications. And with all these things, you can take too much, especially of the vitamin Ks. That's, you know, we don't want to be taking too much of that. Whereas vitamin D is a bit safer, and it would be very hard to overdose on vitamin D, really.
Okay.
If you're taking the high strength or whatever, you kind of, it wouldn't be too bad. But you should just take the recommended amount, which is about 1,000 IU per day. And then if you know if you're feeling really fatigued, or you know you haven't been sort of in the sunlight, you might want to get those levels checked. But it's you don't have to go and have your levels checked. You could just start taking a vitamin D supplement. Again, if you're a complex medical case, or you've got a lot of different conditions happening, you'd want to check that out first. But it's so good. I think vitamin D is sort of underestimated as to how good it is for you.
To me, it just, like, when I think about it, like, getting nutrition from food makes a lot of sense, because it's like, I kind of think of it like, you know, putting petrol into a car. You know, it's like, it's keeps it going. But kind of knowing that you can absorb like vitamins from the sun, like it shouldn't sound far-fetched, but in my mind it sounds kind of nuts that like obviously like a plant gets food or you know gets energy from the sun and you know nutrients from the soil, but also that we can also do that to a certain extent, which yeah, I think when I think about it, it seems a bit weird, but actually it's probably quite normal. It's not, you know, I think, you know, maybe it's another excuse to, you know, it's good to be outside. And like you said, don't get sunburn and particularly that time in the morning. But actually, you know, I know that if I, you know, particularly when it's a little bit gloomy or, you know, the weather's not so great, actually, if you just get out of bed, get straight into the car, go straight to the office, come home, it's dark, then you're inside, like you just don't spend any time outside. So even just like 5 minutes, I actually think it's just quite nice. Just kind of, you know, being in the garden for a little bit, or just kind of, you know, looking at a further afield horizon, I find quite kind of gives me a bit, you know, a bit of clarity in the morning. And then, you know, if you're getting a bit of vitamin D, you know, that's a happy bonus.
Exactly. And it's got so many other health benefits, hasn't it? So obviously mental health, it's always going to give you those benefits as well. And like you said about the exercise, like the kind of nutrition side, I mean, if you eat healthy and you do exercise, fortunately, it's not a marketing thing. It's not, you know, it's not attractive and it's not appealing for somebody to market that, put it in a bottle and go, oh, look, this is like, you can buy this online and you can have this every day. And in 2 days time, you're going to feel amazing. You know, these things are hard work, aren't they? It's hard work to keep a consistent exercise program. It's hard work to keep a consistent food routine and a good, healthy, balanced diet. But it's the biggest reward if you can do that, and your body will thank you for that. And I heard a really interesting quote once, and it said, your older years is a representation of how good you've been to your body through your younger life. And I just thought it was a really nice way of thinking about that, because, yeah, how you are in your later years in terms of how mobile you want to be with, you know, retirement, your grandchildren, whatever, you know, that is a representation of how good you've been throughout your other decades.
I guess people just don't think about that kind of long term, like kind of, you know, like if you try and imagine yourself like when you are retired, or you know, when you are a bit older, and it's not like a kind of natural thing to think about. Like, you know, you might think about, what am I going to have for dinner, or what are we doing on the weekend, or maybe like, what am I, where do I want to go on holiday next year? But I think a lot of people, and myself included, don't often think that far into the future. But actually, when it comes to stuff like health and your body, you know, we've all seen old people who, you know, they're either really hunched up, or you just like, you know, like someone who's clearly not in a great space. When you see something like that, you just think, oh, I really, that doesn't look fun. I wouldn't, you know, that doesn't make me want to get old. And I guess you have to just remind yourself that, you know, that could be a real reality if you don't do something now. And so actually, you know, looking after your body, whether that's through exercise or eating properly, or just, you know, making those conscious decisions to try and put yourself, give yourself the best chance, so that, you know, when you're older and you have got grandkids, that, you know, that actually you can be that fun grandparent and still do stuff and live a fulfilling life. And also on the flip side, there's always those people that you meet who, you know, are old, but they're still living life to the fullest, and you're like, wow, like that's how I would like to be when I'm old. But you know, that's probably also come with that they've either sacrificed, or they've made those conscious decisions to not, you know, do that thing that maybe isn't so good for them, or, you know, to be disciplined, to keep exercising and have a good routine and stuff. And it's easier to say, isn't it? It's harder to do it. But I guess that is kind of part of what this podcast is about, is just to, you know, get us all encouraged to actually do something.
Yeah. And I think, do you know what? I think being in clinic, I see the stories all the time, and I see the effects that, or the conditions that people have to live with. And it's a real wake up call every day. And obviously I'm fortunate enough to help these people, and I love what I do. So I come home and I'm like, okay, and however tired you are, you think, oh gosh, I better do some exercises myself, because I spend all day telling other people to do them. And it is that reminder, because you kind of run away from what you don't want to become. You know, you don't want to, like you said, you want to be that kind of fit, mobile grandparent. And it's devastating for us in clinic if you get people coming in saying, you know, please help me. All I want to do is I want to be able to bend down and see my grandchild, or I want to be able to play with them, or even, you know, younger populations. Or, you know, I'm worried about, you know, I daren't do this because I fear I'm going to do this, or I feel I'm going to break, you know, my back, or yeah, I'm fear of fracture, or now I've broken this and now I can't do that. And you quickly, as you get older, you quickly lose momentum, don't you? You lose more muscle mass anyway. It's harder to regain. It's much harder work. And the people who you do often see, so I often say some of my 80, 90-year-old patients are some of the healthiest patients I ever see in a day, you know, compared to even some 30-year-olds, because and when you question them and you do that as a clinical examination, often you'll sort of pick up as to why they are so healthy with what they do. You know, I love my gardening and I like doing this and I keep active and I eat lots of vegetables. I eat lots of, you know, I don't eat processed food and I don't eat this. And you think, yeah, it all makes sense. And so it does, it really does. Your body is a representation of how good you look after it. And it is the one thing we don't get another one. We just get one body. And I've always found it fascinating. That's why I went into this career. And I just love sharing what I learned, because I just feel like everyone should know about it, because before it's too late, because otherwise one day people wake up. And I hear it all the time, you know, even this week in clinic, you'd hear someone say, you know, suddenly I just got old. Why, you know, I just woke up and suddenly it felt like everything was going wrong. And that's a shame, because the deterioration of whatever is happening way before that moment in time. It's just whether you can recognize the patterns and what things need to change in your life. And when you said earlier, like, what could your wife do? There's things like, there's good research for skipping. So there's a great research article that says if you skip for 16 weeks, so obviously not all for the full amount of time.
Not continuously.
Not continuously for 16 weeks, but if you were to skip a little bit per day for 16 weeks, you can significantly improve your bone density in that course of time. I think it was up to like 40%. So it's quite amazing. High. There are things you can do to make a difference. And any resistive exercise. So if you're just putting a little bit of resistance against the muscle or the body, doing weight resisted, you could just go against the wall with your hands against the wall, do like what we call a little bit of a body press. You just push your body one from the wall and back again. Things like that, especially if you're a little bit older and you're not sure what to do.
So that's a bit easier than, say, a press up on the floor.
Exactly. Yeah. Because if you're kind of, you know, you've got to be a little bit vulnerable, you're going to be a little bit vulnerable maybe in the shoulders as you get older. So doing things that feel kind of that you feel confident to do, especially if anyone has osteoporosis who's listening, you need to be very careful about the type of exercises that you do. And you shouldn't just start, you know, don't just start the skipping that I just said. This is for somebody who is
You want to build up to it.
You want to build up or maybe skipping is not appropriate for that person, because if you've got a history of multiple fractures, you might want to just start with doing things what we call like balance training and ankle strength training, and just starting to work closely with a physio first and then build up slowly.
Well, like having that balance, because obviously, you know, if falling over, obviously if you fall over in tennis or something or off your bike, but that's one thing. But I guess often when you hear of someone falling over, it's like they just tripped over like a step and you know, I kind of think, like, I trip up steps all the time and I rarely fall over. And that's because I guess I've got good reactions and good balance and you can kind of correct yourself. But I guess if you haven't got that, then you fall over. And if you're carrying a bit of extra weight, or, you know, your bones are a bit more fragile, you're more likely to then get a break. And I don't have anything to back this up, but my assumption would be that once you've had that kind of break, that maybe that's the kind of the accelerator of the kind of, oh, I now feel old. Like, because suddenly, you know, if it dramatically changes how you kind of live your life, you know, suddenly you become a bit more sedentary, or, you know, you stop doing certain stuff, then I don't know, I guess in my mind that would seem to make sense. But
So we see it. So I had a patient once who had given up everything. You know, she fell over, say she was in her 80s. She stopped driving. She, you know, she didn't go out as much. She became very housebound. And then, I run like bone density classes at the clinic in Bury. And she started coming to these classes, and you know, she wasn't, she didn't have big expectations of what was going to happen. She thought maybe she'll just get a little bit stronger, and she might, you know, prevent some falls. But after only a few sessions, she said she'd gone back to driving, she'd gone back to all these things, and that's usually unheard of. And some of her friends thought she'd taken some kind of magic pill just to make herself better. But the programs that I run are kind of, I design them based on research. I'm a bit of a geek, really, so I like reading all the scientific journals. And so I very much go by, you know, what is the best exercise and has it really changed? It hasn't really changed in the research. It's all about resistance and balance and fall prevention and that sort of thing. So sometimes we just stand on those like little wobble boards. I don't know if you've ever seen them. They're like little inflatable board. Just because as you mentioned about the ankle and things, if you can improve your ankle strength, you can really reduce your risk of falling, because in our ankles we've got proprioceptors. You can kind of retrain them so that if you do happen to fall or trip or, you know, just knock yourself and you think you're going to go over, if you've got good ankle stability, that's going to help you reduce your chances of fully going over onto the floor and potentially breaking something. So something as simple as that can make a difference. But obviously variety is best. If we can do a little bit of all sorts, really, is the best thing to do.
Yeah. It makes me also think of kind of like that kind of social context of, like, you know, if you're out leading a kind of active life, whether you're into gardening or you go to some club, or, you know, there's something that's kind of, so you're interacting with other people and you're kind of keeping your life kind of quite full, you're probably more likely to be a bit more active, and then also be with people who, you know, are a similar age to you, but they're either a bit healthier or a bit less healthy. And so you can kind of benchmark yourself. But then, you know, you hear a lot in the news, and, you know, and I know a few people who, you know, they kind of retire and then they suddenly leave very kind of small lives, but, you know, they haven't got like a kind of club. So they're just, you know, whether it's just watching daytime TV or Netflix or playing Scrabble, whatever, then they're not kind of getting out there. So therefore they're moving less, and then, you know, they're losing muscle mass because they're older, and then maybe they're not seeing other people. So they're kind of, you know, and then it all kind of declines, doesn't it? And then maybe, like, you know, you become more vulnerable kind of mentally, and then actually you're more prone to kind of hurt yourself, or then have the resilience to like bounce back from, like, you know, that kind of, you kind of see sometimes people kind of look like they've just given up and they've just like accepted, oh, I'm old now and there's nothing I can do about it. And it's kind of like, well, there is something you can do about it. Like, but I guess, but only you can do that. Like, you know, you can lead a horse to water, can't you?
But I
guess it's that thing of, if you think about it now, like, okay, I'm fit, young and healthy, and I don't have to worry about it. But if you kind of think about your future and go, well, actually, I don't want to be in that situation where I am kind of feeling old and vulnerable and not able to like do stuff, and therefore life's just not quite as fun as it used to be. Well, actually, if you don't want to be in that situation, well, now actually you can start, you know, trying to build yourself so that doesn't become a reality. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think all of us just think. We just want to all live, don't we, as healthy as we possibly can, because, you know, there's no fun living life when you're chronically ill. I mean, that's just not pleasant. We see it all the time. And it's really hard. And although, yeah, exercise and any kind of movement is always good for, regardless of whatever condition, there's evidence behind it for all conditions. But it's much harder if that's set in first, isn't it? So you want to, yeah, just keep your fitness levels up as best you possibly can, because you don't really want to end up in that state. And it is really tricky, because, like you say, you do have to put all the kind of effort into doing that. And it is a difficult thing to maintain as you get older, because we just naturally lose fitness anyway. And I think there was a sign once, you know, like on the road signs where you see the kind of icon of two elderly people with a walking stick. Have you ever?
I remember it.
They're not allowed anymore, are they? I don't think they exist. But I think we were kind of, you know, growing up, I think that was the image that you expected an elderly person like.
It's terrible.
It's terrible, isn't it? I mean, hopefully that's still banned, like you shouldn't have those. But, but I mean, you don't want to end up like that. And posture is so important. Like, if people don't want to do anything after this podcast, like, posture is so incredibly important, especially for bone density or osteoporosis, because often you'll end up in quite a flexed posture. So, you know, you sort of see these hyper kyphotic positions. But if you can even, and that has an impact on your digestion and your breathing. So we, you know, elderly people will say, you know, I'm struggling to have a cup of tea because they can't extend their neck because they're so curved over. They might struggle with their breathing. The digestion is just not as great. So posture's got so many good benefits too. But, you know, I see it all the time that youngsters are sitting in terrible positions, and that's not going to do them any favours when they're older. And if you are osteoporotic, listening to this, you should be working on your posture all the time. Just even as something as simple as widening your collarbones and squeezing your shoulder blades back and down behind you. is enough to just open things up gently, and trying to sit more upright rather than that kind of leaning forward flex posture, because that all has
I watched a program on Netflix, and not saying this is the gospel of truth, and it was about a Japanese community, but they mostly sat on the floor, and so they were living quite kind of social lives, but they were sitting on the floor and then getting up from the floor, and often if they were doing something, they were holding something, so they could get up without having to use their hands. And then they were kind of comparing it to kind of most Western people that never sit on the floor, because it's kind of, well, I've got a nice comfy seat, why would I sit on the floor? And actually there was some kind of thought that maybe because they spent quite a lot of time sitting on the floor, that actually they stayed much more kind of active and kind of strong, but it was good for their posture, because obviously when you sit on the floor, it's hard to slouch because there's nothing to slouch on. I don't know, but then because they were with lots of other people who were also doing it, it was like, well, then that was just what they did, you know, so it wasn't kind of, so they were leaving kind of, and I thought that was kind of quite interesting, that maybe we need to stop giving people really comfy chairs with all those kind of magic buttons that make them kind of like lift them out, and actually maybe they should just, you know, sit on the floor more often. I don't know.
Well, it did do a bit of a trend, I remember. I don't know exactly when it was, but we obviously hear about trends all the time in clinic. And then somebody once said to me, like, oh, yeah, it's a measure of fitness if you can get up from the floor with your legs crossed first, whether it's a Christmas party trick or a fitness test. But so there are these things that you hear about.
We did this. We did this in at my work, and it was a bit shocking. So I was able to do it, but actually even the younger people younger than me weren't able to do it. And I was just like, these are warning signs. Like, if you're in your 20s and you can't get up off the floor without using your hands, like, you know, and I guess it's a bit of fun, but actually it's probably a bit of a flag of like, actually, you know, if you've got 100-plus-year-old Japanese lady who's able to do it and is still living a fairly fit and fulfilling life, then maybe if you can't do it in your 20s, that's something to strive for. I don't know.
Yeah, and that should definitely be alarm bells when you're 20. Yeah, absolutely, especially in that position. But like, it's even getting up from the chairs, people, as we get older, we classically see that people will say that they use their hands to push themselves up from a chair. Us being quite mean physios will say, no, you're not allowed to use your hands. You've got to try and, you know, wiggle your bottom to the edge of the chair, you know, try and ground through your feet and push up with your thighs and your bottom to try and propel yourself. And that even doing that can make a huge difference. If you can't do much at all, like, going to make a big difference. And and especially, you know, trying to make yourself sit to stand frequently. So if you're elderly listening to this, or, you know, if everyone happens to be listening to this, then if you're sitting to standing all the time, then that's really good exercise. That's, again, weight bearing if you come up into standing, and it's resistant exercise as well, because you put your foot through the floor.
So not using my arms, just getting up. Okay. But that's such an easy thing to just do, isn't it? Because you know, if you sit down at the table and you get up, you know, people are sitting down all the time. Just great. Well, I think you could turn that into a
fitness test by seeing how fast you can do 10. And you could time yourself. We love timing things in physio, but you could time yourself and see like how quick can you achieve 10? And then you must keep your feet flat on the floor. You know, you mustn't be trying to lift your feet up and trying to, like, some people cheat.
Yes, getting momentum.
But that's a safe exercise for everyone to do, regardless of your age. And I think if you Google it, you'll probably find it. But there's sometimes like a little timetable of what kind of seconds you should reach at different decades of your life. So, you know, if you're taking more than, say, 20 seconds when you're in your 20s, that's really not a good sign. So, but obviously, when you're 80, you might take 26 seconds or a bit longer.
Fine.
Yeah. But there's an interesting breakdown of that you can sometimes come across. But if you're not too competitive, then literally just doing that without timing yourself is really good for you. And you know, it's good for your heart rate. It's good for your sugar levels. It's good for your bones. It's good for your muscles. And it's easy. It doesn't cost anything. And anyone can do it anywhere. And even if you can't do anything at all, like, sitting up posture is also really good. Doing any kind of resistance exercise, so even carrying your shopping, especially when you're older, like, that's also sort of counts, because you're kind of carrying weights. And, you know, and we have people in our clinic, it's so lovely to see when you see sort of elderly people doing exercises in the gym. Like, it's just amazing. And I wish everyone was doing that, because you can really improve. And people think that because they're older, there's no chance of getting any better. They think that they've reached that point and it's only downhill. But you can always improve because our muscles are what we call red muscles. So they can always, you can always build strength. It might take longer as you age, but it's not impossible. And if we don't use it, we lose it pretty much.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, that sounds good. I like the idea of the little competition. I'm definitely gonna time myself. And I was also thinking that kind of image of, the young scout leader, I don't know, helping the old person with their shopping across the road. And actually we, you know, as a young person who's fit and healthy, you know, probably we think that's helping the older person, but actually the older person is better they carry their own shopping because it's going to be good for them. So next time I see an old lady with heavy shopping, I'll applaud her and say, well done, you're doing great job. And of course help her carry it if she asks, but encourage her to carry herself.
Yeah, you're absolutely right though, because we do have, everyone, you know, you care about your loved ones, and we do see, you know, people very concerned, and they'll say that, you know, a very overprotective partner or husband or wife, and, you know, they've got best intentions to look after them. But actually in physio, we sort of have to sometimes say, well, actually, no, you stop helping them in this part, because we want them to do it, because otherwise it's not going to work. And the amount of times I get asked about those postural like straps or things that you can put on to improve your posture, and I say to people, like, they're handy for feedback, so if you're really clueless about where you should be on your posture, but again, that would really need to be put on by a physio to kind of say, like, this, or you know, somebody to say, this is where you should be. But that's not going to do it for you, in the sense that your muscles will get lazy if you wear them all the time, so you get atrophy through the muscles. You have to really do all these things, get your muscles to fire and get the muscles to wake up and give it some work to do. And that's when you'll get the best from it. But I know, Henry, you being in the food industry, brilliant at all your cooking. I know we had a conversation a while back just about how you can naturally get nice collagen from your food when you cook. So tell us more about that, because I can't remember exactly what you told me.
Yeah, well, so for me, collagen obviously has become quite trendy, and you kind of, my social feed seem to be full of people flogging collagen powder in the last few years. I'm sure you've had the same. For me, well, what I know of collagen is really a kind of gateway to gelatin. So as a chef, gelatin is a wonderful thing, because it's it does a few things. It's a flavor carrier. So if you've got like a pot of water and you put some aromats, you know, some herbs, some spices, you know, it'll perfume the water. When you drink it, it'll be quite kind of weak, but if you've got gelatin in the water, it acts as like a little kind of flavor trap, and it absorbs those flavors into it, so you get a more kind of intense and a better flavor coming through the sauce. And so gelatin is really good from that point of view. But also, if you've got it in a gravy or something, it gives you a very nice kind of mouthfeel, as it kind of like coats your tongue. So if you had you know, kind of flavored water, it would just kind of go down quite easily, but you wouldn't necessarily have a kind of part in your mouth. But if you've got gelatin within that water, it's going to coat really nicely, and all those flavors are going to be, you know, explosive and delicious, and it's going to make things taste really nice. So the way that we get this is through bones. So chefs love making stocks, and they're not making stocks because they're fun. They're making them because you're essentially, you're boiling up bones, and within the bones is the collagen, which I think is like the most common protein within the body. I think it's in your skin, it's in the connective tissue, it's in your bones, and so if you boil it, it then extracts that collagen out and then turns it into gelatin, and then you get a lovely kind of wiggly wobbly stock. So for me, the bit that I know through, and this is not because of understanding the science, this is just through trial and error, that certain bones and things will give you more gelatin in tend to be the ones that have a bit more kind of connective tissue or kind of joints. So like chicken wings, for example, will give you a much more gelified stock than, say, if you were just kind of cooking up the rib bones. And same with like a beef stock. If you just have like a rib bone, you'll get a slightly nice flavor, but if you've got like a foot, so like a pig's trotter or a calf foot, you'll get a lot more gelatin coming out of that. So anything that's kind of moving, you're going to get a better stock coming out of it. And so from my point of view, if you want to make a really delicious gravy or something that's like a stew or something that like a risotto that's got some really good flavor and depth, having a really good stock really helps. Now, when you kind of think, you know, if you're running a professional kitchen, you know, you're going to be doing a lot of butchery, so you're going to generate a lot of bones. You'll probably be buying meat from a wholesale butchery. They'll sell you bones because they want to get rid of them, and you're making these in big pots and bubbling away, and they're going to last you for a few days. Now, obviously, at home, most people are not going to be buying in pig's trotters and large right. large boxes of chicken wings, etc., to make stock. So, how do I do it practically myself? The way that I pretty much always make stock is we quite like eating a roast dinner on a Sunday, particularly during the winter. To say we've had a chicken or lamb shoulder or something, whatever it might be, as long as you've cooked it on the bone, rather than discarding that carcass at the end, which a lot of people do, and it's here you've got so much potential and also something for a second meal, is you just take your carcass. Now, it's already been roasted in the oven, so it's already got some nice caramelization, so there's plenty of flavor. There'll be little bits of skin on it. There'll be, you know, a bit of meat you haven't shredded off. Pop it into a pot of water. Now, you don't want to kind of flood it too much. So the way I would do it is put your bones into the pot and kind of squash them down a little bit.
So you've broken it up at the point, have you, Henry?
A chicken carcass, once it's been roasted, it's going to fall to bits fairly easily. If you've got bigger bones, you might find that they don't fit in your pot. So, but a chicken works really well, because a lot of people, you know, a roast chicken is quite a kind of classic Sunday lunch, and it probably makes the most kind of versatile stock. Lamb stock, quite lamby and quite good with lamb dishes, but whereas chicken stock, you can use it for lots of other applications. And then I would then chuck in any kind of leftover veggies that you've got, particularly if you've got like carrots or onions. I wouldn't add things like cauliflower or peas, because they're not gonna bring much to the party. But then you could add in some fresh onions, some chocolate carrots, some bay leaves, a bit of garlic, a thyme if you've got it growing in the garden, some peppercorns, quite good. And then cover it with water. And then if you've got any leftover gravy that you've made, you can just add that in as well, because that's all flavor, you know. And particularly like, and this might not sound appealing to some people, but if your plate is full of gravy and chicken bones, just scrape it all in. Like, it's fine. It's all flavor. It's all delicious. So don't like chuck it away.
Instead of scraping it into the bin, you're scraping it into the pan.
Don't scrape into your bin, because you just end up with a smelly bin then. So actually you might as well, you know, get the flavor out of it. And then you want to bring it to a simmer fairly quickly. And this will bring up any kind of like, essentially kind of scum. That's not right. But you bring it up to a boil, any kind of impurities rise to the top. It's a bit like, you know, when you see like a turbulent sea and it's all kind of like frothy at the top, that essentially all comes to the top. You then turn the boil down so it's much lower, and then just using a spoon, just scoop that off and chuck that away. So that's just the impurities coming out. Now, you'll get more of that if they're raw bones. So if you're cooking it from scratch and you haven't roasted them, you'll get a lot more of this coming up. Whereas from a roasted joint, you probably might get a tablespoon. But if you ever do like a whole pack of chicken wings and you boil them up, you'll be amazed at how much stuff comes out of them. And it's not necessarily bad for your stock, but what it does do is it makes it cloudy. Now, maybe for home use, you don't care. But obviously, if you're selling shiny gravy to people who have spent a lot of money, having a cloudy stock is not a desirable thing. Anyway, so then you just want to like let that simmer for a couple of hours. Now, there's a few things that you can hack with that. One is you can buy yourself a pressure cooker, which just it essentially cooks it under pressure. So I think it like speeds it up by four times. So what could take 5 hours, you can do it in like an hour or an hour and a half. And that kind of slow cooking helps extract all of the flavor, but particularly that collagen out of the bones. You can add like a little, like a capful of vinegar or lemon juice, and that can help speed up that process of extracting the collagen out. But then you won't want to go too much, because you don't want it to taste like vinegar. Now, the other thing is you never season a stock. So if you listen to chefs talk, they'll always talk about season, 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 whereas you never season a stock. And that's because if you then reduce it, if you've seasoned it and you've now got a really nice salty water and then you reduce it, you're going to get it too concentrated. So we always leave the salt out, and then because you can always adjust that later. Now, a few hours later, you know, it's been bubbling away nicely. You then just want to sieve it into a container. Now, a roast chicken stock, you know, I try and make like a liter. So like from one carcass and, you know, like 3-4 hours of bubbling away, you can get a good liter of stock. Now, because it's had a bit of roasting to it, it's going to have like a nice dark brown color to it. Now, once it's cooled, pop that in the fridge. that will last for probably 4 days. It probably lasts longer. The more gelatin you have in it, the longer it lasts. So like the gelatin acts as a kind of, it stops bacteria being able to like travel through the liquid. But what we would tend to do is Monday, we might have, I don't know, something else because Jess doesn't want to eat chicken. You know, the kids like, we had that yesterday. But then kind of Tuesday, Wednesday, you can use that to make a really great ramen. Now, it's such an easy dinner because you literally just, you get your liter of stock, you pour that into a pan. Now, if you want to go super fancy, you can add things like kombu and some katsuobushi and, you know, and make essentially like a mirin stock. You don't have to do that. You could just add some soy sauce, some, those little dried mushrooms are quite nice, maybe some ginger, some garlic. A bit of miso paste is really good, you know, really good for you, particularly if you buy the live miso, it's going to be really good for your gut. And then you just, essentially, you bring it to the boil, cook some noodles on the side. You could boil an egg if you want, and then just shred in your chicken, any kind of leafy greens. So you talked about your vitamin K from your kale and stuff, chuck that in, just chop up some spring onions. You can get loads of lovely veggies in and essentially just taste it, season it, and you've got yourself a really delicious bone broth, essentially.
Wow.
That's going to be full of flavor. And also it's coming from a meal that you've already paid for. So you've already paid for your chicken. Now, okay, yes, you've got a little bit of extra veg, but really, you know, it's pennies. And actually you're going to have yourself a really delicious meal. And my kids absolutely love it. So it's And what we quite like doing is, because, you know, I like mine with a bit of spice in it, or I might want to put some kimchi in and they're not so into that. So you can almost do it. It's like you just give them the broth and then you just have like your chopped up bits on the outside. And then you just kind of add what you want, you know. So Jess would probably absolutely load hers up with, you know, kale or, you know, any kind of leafy green because she loves that. I'd probably have more chicken because I quite like that. And you know, you just, you know, a sprinkle of some toasted sesame seeds and a bit of sesame oil on top. You know, you'll have something that will, you know, be far nicer than what you'd get at Wagamama.
Oh,
I don't know if wrong with Wagamama, of
yeah,
course.
That sounds really
and it just, you know, it's using up all of your leftover bits. And yeah, totally delicious. But or you could just use it, you know, as the base for, you know, if you're going to make a chicken pie, for example, say you've got loads of shredded chicken left, you could then use that to thicken your gravy, you know, or your sauce, and it's just going to have so much more flavor and it's going to be the nicest pie that you've ever made.
Yeah, I guess you could. Could you also use... I remember like when I make risottos, I normally use a stock. So you could just use that into the risotto rice when you're cooking it off with onions. Would that work the same, or do you have to try and convert
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, absolutely. So like a risotto made without stock is just kind of boiled rice. So like it's not like, it, yes, you can put loads of cheese. There's only so much Parmesan and butter that you can add to a risotto without the stock. The stock is like, I always think of it like an orchestra. There's different, you know, when you hear it all together, it sounds wonderful. But like if you hear the individual instruments, they can sound a bit like so what? Like a tuba is probably fairly, no one wants to listen to the tuba all day long without some other instruments to accompany it. And a stock kind of really kind of like brings everything together. And, you know, you might have that little bit of acidity and that's like, you know, the oboe. It's like, I don't even know what an oboe sounds like, but if you took it out, you would miss it. It'd be that little high note that goes like, oh yeah, that just, you know, makes it sore or something. And I actually know nothing about music. So, but that's how I kind of imagine it. It's like, it's a collection of things coming together and a stock can just elevate particularly that kind of depth of flavor. But also if you've got a stock that's got lots of collagen in it, it's also elevating it because when you're eating it, that gelatin's coating your tongue and your mouth and it's giving you a kind of a richer, more intense flavor because, you know, all those other flavors that you've added aren't just being washed down. Actually, they're kind of lingering in your mouth more, which makes it taste nicer. And now this is, so for me, like I get excited by bones because of gelatin. And then lo and behold, turns out it's really good for you. And so.
Exactly.
So it's kind of like, so I'm like, it's a win-win. I'm like, it's great. Like I love gelatin, you know, it's a great thing in cooking. And
good
actually
for your hair and nails as well. It's so good for your hair, skin and nails, all the gelatin and the collagen. So how would you quickly turn it into a tasty gravy? And I assume you could do that around Christmas time as well, just keeping it in the fridge for a few days, it would last. You could do like a get okay. ahead gravy, couldn't you?
Yeah, Christmas. Yeah. If I do Christmas dinner, I do Christmas dinner every bloody year.
I hope so.
Now, there's no getting away from it. So you buy yourself the best turkey you can afford. I would then chop off the wings because generally speaking, the wings, you know, people don't tend to eat them. They look quite nice, but just chop them off. Now, there's a tutorial on YouTube. You can read how to do that. Sharp knife, don't chop your fingers. I'd also then chop off the parson's nose, which is that kind of bit at the front, because again, there's not a huge amount of meat on there, but there is loads of collagen in it. So I would take them off the day before. I would then roast them up with some onions, carrots, some celery, and then into a pan or a pot, and then boil it up with some aromats, some herbs, spices, etc., and make yourself a really kind of dark turkey stock. Then Christmas Day, you roast your turkey, and it's now roasted to perfection. You then take it out the tray, and you've got your you know, the bottom of the tray, you've had some onions and some garlic and some carrots and stuff, and they've all kind of caramelized down, and there's all the kind of juices that have come out of the turkey that have now started to kind of like, they look a little bit like kind of like a Bovril kind of Marmite-y thing. So then you put that tray onto your stove, you start to heat it up, and you might want to loosen it with a bit of, you could add a bit of water just to kind of like loosen it off, or, you know, a splash of wine would be really good, you know, whatever you've got, like a nice glass of white wine or so, and boil that off. That gives a bit of acidity. So again, it's like that kind of oboe. Now, depending on how you like your stock, so some people like their gravy just like flavorsome and thin, some people like it thicker. So my father-in-law likes his to be thick enough that the spoon will stand up in it. I've kind of weaned him off that, but I know that if I give him a very thin gravy, he's not gonna be too pleased. He likes something with a bit of thickness. So I would then just add some flour into the pan, again cook it, stir it around with all the kind of bits and veggies in and stuff, and allow the kind of flour to cook out and start to thicken. Then you add in your stock that you've made the day before or a few days before, and then you just want to like simmer it and reduce it in the pan, and then after kind of like 10-15 minutes or so, you can then just sieve that into a smaller pan. Any kind of fat will then rise to the top, and you can just lift that off. It's good to leave like a little bit of fat, but you don't want like a kind of an inch of, particularly if it's a free range bird, it might have quite a lot of fat come off it, because it's just going to be kind of greasy on your plate. So then just sieve that out, and you can save that for, you know, something else, putting over your roast potato, so to speak. And then you just want to taste it. So obviously seasoning is super important. And then checking for acidity again. So whether it, like a little splash of something like a sherry vinegar would be nice at Christmas, you know, like a little softer than a kind of white wine vinegar. Something that's just going to add a little bit of acidity, but not too much harshness. And then because it's Christmas, we're then going to do something called montu beurre, which is essentially, it's French for mounted butter, which sounds kind of weird. Essentially, you get cold butter, and we're just going to whisk that into the pan. And what that does is it kind of emulsifies the butter into the pan, into the gravy, sorry. It gives it a slight thickness, but it gives it a real richness and a super shine. So when you go to a fancy restaurant and you've got like this beautiful gravy, and it's like shiny and glossy, and you eat it and you're like, what is in that? Well, it's probably more. About 4 days of effort to get to that point. And that started off with, I don't know, 20 liters, and now they've got a liter left. And but that little bit of whisking of butter in just kind of, it makes it sing. And now I'm not saying you need to do this for every gravy, but it's Christmas, hey, so you might as well.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. And can you use any flour, like corn flour? Can you just use whatever you've got, like plain flour? Does it have to be a particular one?
No, anything. I mean, I'd go, obviously, I tend to go plain flour just because I think there's actually a nice bit of flavour to it. A corn flour works really well, particularly if it's a bit thin and you want to then add it later on, so you can make a little slurry. And essentially, like bitter dough is just corn flour with some beefy elements added to it, and that's why you can add it at the end of a gravy. Whereas if you add flour into the gravy at the end, you can end up with just lumpy bits of flour floating around. So corn flour works as like the end one. It kind of like corn flour can give it a kind of like shininess and a kind of slightly cheaper taste. I don't know. Like I don't love corn flour. Like it's not my favorite. Like it's a backup one. Whereas I think flour, you get a slightly nicer texture. But that's just my preference. But then actually, like if I was making it not for my father-in-law, I probably wouldn't put any flour in it, because I'd want I'd rather work on a kind of reduction, so actually reducing the stock down, because it's just going to intensify those flavors. But then you end up with a lot less gravies. If you're feeding 20 people or for 10 people, and you know that your uncle is going to smash through half a liter of gravy, then using flour is a great way to bulk it out a little bit. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. But probably if you're sitting in a fine dining restaurant, and they probably haven't thickened it with flour, because it's kind of it's giving it more body rather than kind of the reduction side, where actually you're getting more of that kind of collagen and gelatin, which gives you more flavor in your mouth and a better feel. Another thing you can do, and if you really get into making stock and you really want this collagen, is that you can make yourself a big pot of gelatinous stock, and then you can reduce it right down. And then what you can do is you can then pour it into an ice cube tray. Now you'd want this to be like, to go from like 2 liters down to kind of 250 mils. So like really hard anything, and it'll feel kind of thick and shiny on the spoon. You pour that in, pop that in the freezer, and then pop them out. And then if ever you've got like a sauce or a gravy that's feeling a bit lacking because you haven't made the gravy, you can just chuck one of those in. And it's almost like adding like a Bisto cube, but it's kind of, it's not going to be full of, you know, it's, you've made it yourself. It's, and it's full gelatin, and it'll just lift everything and make it delicious.
I love that. Yeah, that's so a great little hack, so that's, isn't it?
No, if you like prepping, that's something you can do. Yeah.
Love a bit of preparation. Yeah, that sounds fantastic. Well, you've made me really hungry now, Henry. Yeah. And I think we've given everyone quite a lot to digest there, literally, haven't we? With how they can look after their bone health. So that's fantastic. Well, thanks so much for those top tips, Henry. That's really useful. I'm going to try that for my gravies. And it's really great to know I don't have to bother with corn flour, because it's often something I'll put away and then I'll leave it in the cupboard and then I'll be like, oh, it's kind of gone off, I think. So so it's good that you can use any.
Yeah, thank you. And great. I love all those tips. I'm going to definitely be getting out of my chair without using my hands. I think that's a good little test. And also just that kind of, yeah, thinking about your future health. And, you know, being a bit more conscious about it, I'm definitely going to have a chat with the wife and kind of, I don't know, but even if we don't make a plan, just actually like, you know, just kind of being aware that there's things that we can do now that could really be beneficial later on in life.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Brilliant. Well, thanks very much, Henry. Until next time, we'll see you soon.
Cheers, Hayley.
Cheers, Henry.